Your daughter has schizophrenia, I told the woman. Oh, my God, anything but that, she replied. Why couldn't she have leukemia or some other disease instead? But if she had leukemia, she might die, I pointed out. Schizophrenia is a much more treatable disease. The woman looked sadly at me, then down at the floor. She spoke softly. I would still prefer that my daughter had leukemia. That's from the preface to a book called Surviving Schizophrenia, a Family Manual. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Say the word schizophrenia and people think of hallucinations, delusions, violent behavior, and a splitting of self. Yet some people with schizophrenia live productive and fulfilling lives, even working as physicians and counselors. What is this mental illness? And how do we distinguish schizophrenia from other disorders such as bipolar? What myths and misconceptions do we have about schizophrenia? What forms of treatment and crisis management are available? Joining us to discuss schizophrenia is Dr. Ronald Diamond, professor of psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin and the medical director of the Mental Health Center of Dane County.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
The very word schizophrenia invites people to think that there's some kind of a split going on, a split personality. Is that at all legitimate, or is that just confusion?
Mostly it's confusion. There is often confusion between schizophrenia and multiple personality or split personality, which has nothing to do with schizophrenia. The term schizophrenia was actually developed by Max Fleurs Bleuler, a Swiss psychiatrist, and it meant the dissolution of the ego, the sense of self, that typically what we think, how we behave, how we feel are all somehow connected. And his idea in schizophrenia was these things became disconnected, and that's where the schiz came into.
So you're, instead of personality split, it's some kind of holistic split there between emotion and sensation.
That was the old idea. I don't think that's what we think now. But the idea of the dissolution of the sense of self or the personality was where the term came from. And whether we like it or not, that is the term that we continue to use.
I'm guessing it must go way back to the beginnings that there were people in history who had this and just didn't have the name for it.
Well, as far back as we have written records about medicine, there have been descriptions about madness or psychosis or people who had altered beliefs. So as far as we could tell, psychosis and psychotic disorders and probably schizophrenia is present in every civilization and society in the world for as far back as we've had people.
So are there some notable cases where we can say this clearly was a case of schizophrenia? I mean, whether you're talking about, you know, Joan of Arc and her voices or the witches supposedly at Salem or other historical figures, are there any places where we can say, well, this really sounds like they had the symptoms of schizophrenia?
Well, what you can say is that these people didn't particularly fit into their society and had beliefs that were a divergence from their mainstream society, but that's different than schizophrenia. And I must say I'm hesitant to make a historical diagnosis without enough information. We know that Joan of Arc, from the historical record, was an odd woman who had beliefs different than people around her. Whether that was schizophrenia or not, I'll keep to my private beliefs.
With most disorders, there's a whole set of criteria in very authoritative manuals and so on. And if you're trying to define schizophrenia then and distinguish it from something else, what would you look to as a definition?
Well, the current diagnostic criteria for schizophrenia include a number of different points. First of all, there has to be a period of psychotic disorder. That is, the person is out of touch with reality. They might be hearing voices. They might be believing things that other people don't believe, that are not socially or culturally sanctioned. They may have fragmentation or disorganization of thinking that is significant enough to really interfere with the ability to function and communicate. That's one part of the criteria. The second part is it has to continue for a period of time. It turns out that a whole variety of things can cause people to become psychotic for brief periods of time, weeks or days or whatever. And so we want to make sure that we don't confuse a brief psychotic episode of one sort or another with schizophrenia. The third is we want to make sure that there's not a medical or medication or drug-induced cause for this. We know that if we keep people sleep-deprived long enough, we can cause psychotic symptoms no matter who they are. And then we want to make sure that it's not confused with some other mental illness, that somebody in an acute manic episode can also become psychotic. People with a delusional depression can become psychotic. And cross-sectionally at any given point, people with a manic episode can look indistinguishable at that moment from somebody with schizophrenia. So we're talking about a psychotic disorder that endures for more than 6 months without a clear medical or other reason for it that's not better explained by some other mental illness.
And this can come on to somebody who, so far as we know, for the first part of their life, 10, 20 years, can manifest no symptoms of schizophrenia?
Absolutely. There's some very interesting studies now going on about whether there are, in fact, very subtle indicators early on. We believe that this is a neurobiological disease that develops as the brain matures. And it turns out that if you look back to people who become schizophrenic, have their first psychotic episode when they're 20 or 25, there are very few ways of distinguishing them at 10 or 12 from the general population. On the other hand, if you look at home videos of kids with schizophrenia, if I gave you 100 home videos and I said which of these people developed schizophrenia, you would not be able to tell. But if I give you a forced choice, I say one of these two children developed schizophrenia and one did not, then you're highly likely to guess correctly which one, in fact, did. And so there's some kind of very subtle interpersonal cues that may be available that we're not quite sure how to pick up or what to do with. But this is a very fascinating area of research.
Is it that they're acting a little different, that there's just something off or unusual or unconventional?
Well, it's not so different that people can easily distinguish. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the problems as we try and develop diagnostic systems for schizophrenia early and earlier is if you look at teenagers who have eccentric thinking, have odd behaviors, are socially clumsy, you develop a large number of young people, most of whom go on to do quite fine. So you can develop people who have some increased risk, but it's very hard to go from that to a diagnosis. So it's unclear exactly what we're picking up or what the early signs are. We do know that there seems to be some cognitive changes in thinking before the development of the first psychotic episode. So there is a lot of research about what's happening with the brain, with the maturation of the brain, and with very subtle social cues. But right now, there are more questions than answers.
I saw this really scary program. I think it was on 2020 or on Primetime Live. I don't remember what. But it was on children with schizophrenia. And they were so violent, attacking their parents and, you know, just completely out of control. And I think the popular conception of schizophrenia, as in the opening that I read where the mother would prefer leukemia to it, I mean, a lot of it comes from this fear that it goes along with just incredibly violent, dangerous behavior. But in this case, it was children.
Yeah. Well, let's get the violence out of the way. The best available evidence would suggest that there is a very, very slight increase in violence connected to schizophrenia than the general population. But to put that in context, we know that men are more violent than women. We know that young men are more violent than older men. The differences between gender and the differences between age are much, much more significant in terms of risk for violence than having or not having schizophrenia. On the other hand, we know that substance use hugely inflates the risk of violence. So if you want to ask a question about whether this person is likely to be violent, ask if, in fact, they have an untreated substance abuse problem. And then it doesn't matter whether they have schizophrenia or not. It is the substance use that carries most of the risk. Most people with schizophrenia are not violent. Most of them are victims of violence rather than perpetrators. And in fact, as a person who's worked with people with schizophrenia for the past 35 years, I find there a tremendous amount to empathize and respect people with schizophrenia. Hang in there and keep trying and working at things in a way that I think I would have given up long ago. Now, we talk about schizophrenia, we talk about it as though it's one illness, and virtually nobody believes it is a single illness. It's probably a variety of different conditions with certain common pathways involved, but the very rare condition of childhood schizophrenia, which was on the TV, is very rare, it's very unusual, and it's unclear how connected that is to the more typical syndromes of schizophrenia that we see developing in late adolescence through the 20s and 30s. But schizophrenia probably is going to turn out to have a variety of genetic and non-genetic factors, and we're going to see that we break this down into a variety of different specific illnesses, just as we have with fever or with other things.
But one of the hallmarks of it you mentioned is the psychotic episode. What exactly does that mean, then, if it's not necessarily a violent situation?
Well, first of all, not all people with schizophrenia are psychotic all the time. This is part of the phase of the illness, but most people I work with, in fact, are not currently psychotic at any way. But psychosis means a break with reality, and there are different ways to think about that. It can include hearing voices or seeing things or listening to music or smelling things, any kind of change in perception that other people don't hear. One of the people I worked with had a delusion of hearing voices, hallucination of hearing voices. And as somebody who likes music, I said, how bad is that? And he said, well, think about what would happen if your teenage daughter was able to control the music station and the volume of earphones you couldn't take off. And you got a sense of what it would be like. Let's say that there was an earphone TV or radio station of your most obnoxious channel as we're trying to have this conversation, and you could imagine what that was like. Another part of psychosis can be delusions, that is, beliefs that other people don't hold on to. And somebody may have a delusion that a chip has been put in their brain, or that hundreds of thousands of dollars has been stolen, or that they're married to the president of the United States. And a lot of times people say, well, why do people hold on to such strange beliefs? And the reality is that we hold on to all of our beliefs because there are beliefs. You have a belief that you're an engineer in this music station, WHA, and if I tried to convince you that you were not, even if, in fact, the paperwork supporting it, even if your name was no longer on the door, you would, in fact, be hard to convince. If, in fact, if I said you were not really employed here, and, in fact, your name was off the door, you couldn't find paperwork, you couldn't find check stubs, your immediate reaction was not to thank me for correcting your misperception. It would be to think there's a conspiracy.
Wow, fascinating.
And so we hold on to all of our beliefs with tenacity. And people with schizophrenia who have beliefs that, in fact, are not well-founded hold on to them in the same way you hold on to your beliefs about where you work or who you're married to or other parts of your life. A third area of psychosis is thought disorganization, that our thoughts more or less follow a linear pattern of one thing connected to another. And thoughts can get so jumbled that, in fact, people don't make sense. It's hard to follow the conversation. Things jump around so there's no clear references. And this illogicity of thought is another characteristic of the psychosis. But while we think of schizophrenia in terms of psychosis, that's only the most dramatic. It's actually not the most disabling part of the illness.
The description of it seems like nightmares and dreams. The way it's your brain that's creating these dreams and nightmares, but you're not exactly in control. And then that feeling that all of us have when we wake up and you're sorting through, was that real? You know, is there any piece of it? Is there any truth to it? Is there any link between what goes on in sort of dreaming nightmare world and what happens in the brain of someone with schizophrenia?
Well, that's been studied from the time of Freud and Jung and even before, and many people have written much about that. One thing they have in common is that dreams and nightmares are pre-verbal. That is, we assign verbal meaning to these things, but they probably arise out of a part of the brain that doesn't use language, and therefore we explain it after the fact, as it were. And I think perhaps some of the experiences of people with psychosis also explain it after the fact. There's a much more modern neuroscience part to this, which is just fascinating. In a very recent article published in the American Journal of Psychiatry by work done here in the Department of Psychiatry at Madison, it turns out that there's a part of the brain that develops patterns when you're asleep called the sleep spindles. And this has to do with the connection between a deeper part of the brain called the caudate and the outside part of the brain called the cortex. And it turns out that with very fancy computer analysis, sleep spindles in people with schizophrenia are consistently different than people without schizophrenia. And this may, in fact, be the harbinger for a major neuroscience breakthrough about some of the basic neuroscience causes of this illness. And this is very exciting stuff. Not about dreams, but about something about the sleep architecture that may give us some important cues.
And if we look, or more appropriately, listen to these voices that are part of schizophrenia, sometimes at least, can we actually track what's going on in the brain now when these voices are being heard? I mean, is it actually some kind of auditory center that's being triggered?
There's a lot of work about that, and again, it's our ability to track what's going on in the brain is not precise enough for that. If you're hearing my voice or a voice in your head that's not my voice, we can't exactly track what that signal is in your brain real time, whether it's an auditory hallucination or whether a real voice. What we know is that there's increased activity in your temporal lobe, which processes information, and that happens no matter what kind of voice you're paying attention to. So there's a lot of work about what is the processing that's going on.
You mentioned bipolar a minute ago, and can you distinguish between bipolar, schizophrenia, and schizoaffective disorder and any other disorders that we ought to know about?
Sure. One of the canons in psychiatry from 1900 was that people with psychotic disorders are either one or the other. You either have schizophrenia or you have a manic depressive bipolar disorder, and these were the two major categories developed by Kraepelin and continue to the current day. I think the real situation is much more confusing and complex with this. These are probably both multi genetic disorders. There's a tremendous amount of overlap in family pedigrees that, in fact, there are people with schizophrenia who have very little mood variation. And there are people with tremendous mood variation, that's pure bipolar, that between episodes don't look like they have any elements of ongoing schizophrenia. There's also a spectrum of people that seem to have some elements of schizophrenia, some elements of bipolar, that between manic episodes or depressed episodes, they still have some degree of eccentric thinking, that the family pedigrees don't seem to be as cleanly distinct, that in fact, if you have a family member with one of these disorders, you're more likely to develop either one of these disorders. So the term schizoaffective is people who continue to have elements of schizophrenia even between their affective, bipolar, manic, or depressive episodes. But in fact, I think there's a whole spectrum or a continuum between these. And I think our historical categorization that you have one or the other in some kind of box probably doesn't represent how real people exist.
Do external forces, this is always a hard thing to distinguish in nature from nurture and that kind of thing. It seems that they're always so interconnected. But can events in a person's life trigger then these psychotic episodes or trigger an onset of schizophrenia?
Absolutely. And in fact, one of the things that we have gotten away from is it nature or nurture? Because the answer is in almost all cases, yes, both, yeah. Always. Some of the things are more clear cut. So that we know, for example, that heavy and persistent marijuana use probably doesn't cause schizophrenia. But if you're biologically predisposed by family pedigree or other things, it is likely to have the illness expressed earlier and perhaps more strongly. Perhaps some people would develop schizophrenia because of their marijuana use that would not otherwise develop it despite having some family biological predisposition.
So is marijuana versus some other substance?
Well, we know more about marijuana. There's more statistical connection about it. We have more people using it in high dose on a regular basis. But there seems to be a connection between the development of schizophrenia, early onset, and marijuana, for example, different than alcohol. And we don't have enough information with cocaine or with the hallucinogens. I'm not saying that they're not causally connected, but we just have information about marijuana. We also know that if you have schizophrenia, not in a way of causing it, but if you have it and you're exposed to very hostile, critical environments, you're more likely to have a relapse than if you're in a more benign, supportive, positive environment.
Well, I'm thinking of somebody, for example, in the military.
Or somebody with staff that's particularly critical or in a family that is having trouble and therefore critical. That is, criticalness comes in a variety of different ways. And we're not talking about a chance comment that you happen to be working with somebody for 20 minutes.
Persistent system.
But a persistent system of criticalness seems to massively increase the relapse potential for somebody who's having trouble with dealing with that kind of emotional overload. So we know of some biological variables that seem to make it more likely. We know of some social variables that seem to make it more or less likely. We also know, and there's a fascinating finding, that if you look at schizophrenia in developed countries, London, Washington, D.C., Moscow, or underdeveloped countries, parts of India or Africa, the percentage of people with schizophrenia who do really, really badly, the worst quartile, is about the same. And that seems to be driven biologically. It probably does not seem to be that dependent on social aspects. But the number of people who are doing really well, who fit in, who are symptom-free, who are full social members of the society, seems to be better in underdeveloped countries than in Western industrial countries.
Why would that be?
Yeah, why attribute to that?
Why is that? Well, that's really fascinating. But if you think about this as a plastic interactive system, it's not just biological or just social, that if you have schizophrenia and life is more difficult, you work a bit more slowly, you're a bit more socially clumsy, and you live in Washington, D.C., what that means is you don't work. It means you don't get married. It means you don't have a family. It means that you fall out of all of the social systems that give you positive reinforcement about who you are and what you could be. Whereas if you're on an agrarian community in India and you have the same kind of problems, you're still working on your brother's farm, perhaps not as fast as everyone else, but you're still working. You're still in an arranged marriage. You still have children that are cared for by the extended community. There are all kinds of feedback systems that allow you to fit in and integrate. And not only does this let you have a better social quality of life, but in fact, this seems to increase your ability to deal with symptoms, and so you have fewer psychotic symptoms. One of the things that we know can decrease rehospitalization rate is helping somebody get a job and support them in a job. And for somebody who's socially awkward, who has trouble with interpersonal relationships, this can be a difficult task. But we know how to help people with schizophrenia get jobs, and we know that this is a very effective pro-social way to both increase their stability in the community, decrease their symptoms, and also improve their quality of life.
So for a schizophrenic person who wouldn't necessarily get as much support in everyday life as he or she might need, would the ability to lavish care, express affection on someone or something else, such as a pet, enhance their way of life?
Well, in fact, pet therapy is a very important thing. It doesn't necessarily replace people, but I have a lot of patients for whom pets are a very, very important part of their life, and they have a relationship with the pet that they may not have with anyone else. It's a way of relating to something that relates back to them. It's an animate object. So for a lot of people, that, in fact, becomes, whether they have schizophrenia or whether they don't, for a lot of us, our pets are, in fact, very important parts of our social feedback
system.
That
unconditional love, I suppose.
We're going to look more at the symptoms and treatment of schizophrenia when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. At 30 years of age, Nash suffered the first shattering episode of paranoid schizophrenia, the most catastrophic, protean, and mysterious of mental illnesses. For the next 3 decades, Nash suffered from severe delusions, hallucinations, disordered thought and feeling, and a broken will. In the grip of this cancer of the mind, as the universally dreaded condition is sometimes called, Nash abandoned mathematics, embraced numerology and religious prophecy, and believed himself to be a messianic figure of great but secret importance. That's from A Beautiful Mind, talking about Nobel laureate John Nash and his descent into schizophrenia. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is Ronald Diamond. We're talking about schizophrenia. Let me ask you about that term I just used, paranoid schizophrenia. Are all forms of schizophrenia linked with paranoia? And if we've taken our image of this disease from the movie A Beautiful Mind, do we have a pretty good sense of it?
We have a sense of some parts of it. I actually don't think that the subcategories of paranoid or hebephrenic or disorganized hold very well. They don't give us much additional information. But as a descriptor, there are some people whose belief systems are more organized. They hold together. They're more organized in their thinking about it. And John Nash's belief system was exquisitely organized. I mean, it started from false assumptions, but from those assumptions, it was completely consistent. There are other people who are more disorganized in their belief system. One piece is not as connected and tightly to another person. So you can describe people who are more organized in their belief. You can describe people who have more disorganization and thoughts that just don't hold together, that are just floating around. You can have people that are more socially incapacitated because they really don't have any relatedness to other people. And people, despite their schizophrenia, who are exquisitely connected to other people. So there are descriptive differences, but I don't know that the subcategories in the current diagnostic nomenclature give us very much additional help. The idea that people with schizophrenia are very different, that some are brilliant and some are not very smart, that some are great musicians and some can't play a note, that some people with schizophrenia are extraordinarily nice and giving human beings and others are not, we should understand that this is only one aspect of who the person is. And if I describe you by your job title or by any other part of who you are, that's going to be very incomplete. And we make the mistake of thinking we know more about somebody because of their diagnostic label. And that's one of the take-home messages.
Well, you've mentioned that it has a genetic component to it. So we see multiple generations of schizophrenia in a family, or is it a more rare thing than that?
Well, as with other things, it's halfway in between. We know that the general prevalence of schizophrenia is about 1% of the population. About 1 out of 100 of us are going to develop this disorder. And if you think about immediate family, friends, neighbors, this means very many of us are going to be impacted on it. If we have a first-degree family member, if we have a brother, sister, one parent, the chance of somebody developing schizophrenia is about 10 to 12%, 10 times the general population, but still way, way under half. If I have an identical brother with schizophrenia, my chance of developing the illness is about 50%, which is still very high, but still not 100%. So we know that there are parts of this illness that are carried in non-genetic factors, and that varies from one person to the other. We have families with very, very strong family pedigrees, and we have other people who develop schizophrenia when nobody in the family has ever had it before.
What about the ratio of men to women and also within various ethnic populations?
I'm not aware that there are any differences among ethnic populations. One of the very strong findings that's in every study when it's been looked at is that immigrants are more likely to develop schizophrenia than people who stay at home from the same population base. And you could think about this as being a stress issue, that if you're an immigrant, it's much more stressful. You could also think that the immigrants are the people who didn't quite fit in to their home community.
So they're pre-selected.
So they're pre-selected. And there's been a debate going back and forth forever about, is the increased risk of schizophrenia among the immigrants from the stress or from the self-selection or from some combination of the two? And I'm not saying that a large percentage of immigrants develop schizophrenia, but it's a little bit higher than the base rate of whatever their community comes from. We know that men are slightly more likely to develop schizophrenia than women. I think that men are more fragile in a variety of ways, but that's a different show. And we know that men are more likely to develop schizophrenia earlier and probably have a more severe form of the disease. Again, there's a connection between the biology and the sociology and the psychology of it, which is hard to disentangle. My expected role as a male in the United States is to go out to get a job and to be active in my pursuit of a mate or friends. It is somewhat easier and more acceptable for a woman who may not have quite as good a social skill set to be more passive, to not go out and get the same kind of job, to be the person who's asked out instead of the person who has to ask out. So it may be that part of this is really a biological difference. It may be that, in fact, that there are other issues about gender. But the social roles may be different between the genders.
Well, isn't it possible that women are by nature more sociable than men anyway, and that could play to their advantage in terms of ameliorating symptoms?
Absolutely. And that's actually one of the things that's been discussed, that women have much more intact social networks, whether they have schizophrenia or if they get older or whenever things happen to them. And this seems to increase resiliency tremendously.
Well, let's take – I realize that there's probably no such thing as a typical patient with schizophrenia, because what you're saying is it's a whole spectrum and that every person is different. But can you give us some sense of how this disease usually manifests itself? You said that, you know, often it's late adolescence to early 20s. You know, let's say you've got somebody – give us a sense of what the symptoms would be or what the natural progression might be if somebody's is listening right now and trying to figure out, gosh, is the relative that I – have been worried about, do they have schizophrenia and what would be the procedure to get them a diagnosis?
Sure. Well, often the first thing that comes to people's attention is something fairly dramatic, like A Beautiful Mind, where the first person, John Nash, became clearly delusional. He started believing things that, as you listen to it, became more and more and more improbable to the point where there was no possibility. But if you look back behind that, there's almost always a precursor. There is a period of months or longer where the person wasn't functioning quite as well, school wasn't going quite as well, job wasn't going quite as well. There seems to be more cognitive thinking difficulties for a period of time, almost always before that first index psychotic episode. Sometimes those episodes developed abruptly and dramatically. Sometimes people just slide into them slowly over time. One of the people I've been working with since the late 70s is a man who at 16 went from being a fairly brilliant student and a great musician to becoming more and more socially awkward, more difficulty going to school, started dropping out of school, was in a very intellectual family where everyone else had PhDs, and that was the expected course for this kid. And until 16, that was the course he was on. But from 16 to 18, without any psychotic symptoms, he, in fact, just was less and less able to cope with the world. And it wasn't until he was in his senior year of high school and became overtly psychotic, hearing voices and responding to voices in a very scary way, that the diagnosis was eventually made. So the precursor period can be very brief or very long. It can be dramatic or not. But the psychotic symptoms are what usually bring people to attention. This can be any time from 16 to 36. And with many other illnesses, schizophrenia can be very, very severe or relatively mild as these things go and pretty easily treated. One of the people I work with who's now a physician became ill when he was in medical school. He was brilliant, and he was smart enough to have developed a whole variety of delusional beliefs, very much like John Nash had, which he was smart enough to keep quiet because he thought people would think he was nuts, which, in fact, they would have. And it came out when he was told that he needed to start propositioning women in his class in a very inappropriate way, very out of character to who he was.
He was told by these voices.
He was told by these voices that all of a sudden this psychotic experience that he had been living with for several years at that point, very connected to his family, very connected to lots of other people, and he had kept this completely under wraps. And it came out very dramatically, very embarrassingly. Nobody got hurt. He was somebody who responded dramatically well to medication and is now functioning in a way that were you to be in his office, you would not know that he had an illness. Now, even here, he went from somebody who was looking towards being a brilliant MD, PhD, research, Nobel Prize winner to somebody who says, when you talk to him, you know, I can function okay, but it's not the same. I've lost something. And he has dropped out of his research agenda. He's a clinician, doing quite well, very competent, did very well in the rest of his medical school. But he would say, in subtle ways, I lost something in the course of this. Not enough that you talking to him, even if you knew him well, would know, but he's aware of. So there is that subtlety of what kind of cognitive decline do people get into.
So he lost some kind of creative aspect of his thinking?
Yes. And he would say, I'm less smart than I was, and that's
less imaginative.
Less imaginative, less something. And that's part of what's described. Now, all of that is relative. There is a wonderful, wonderful book called The Center Cannot Hold by Ellen Sachs, who is a woman who became ill when she was 16 and ended up being psychotic more or less from that time to her adulthood and writing in this wonderfully articulate style what the experience was like. And while psychotic, she graduated valedictorian from her college, took a philosophy degree from Oxford, went through Yale Law School, and is now a tenured professor in law at UCLA, and has written about her experience with the illness. And my guess, it also has affected her cognitive capacity and intelligence, so it dropped it from 200 IQ to 180 or something of that sort. All these things are relative, and she, in her book, talks about how things are more difficult because of her illness. That doesn't mean that they're impossible.
One of the students that I've had over the years, undergraduate students with schizophrenia, I think one of the things that seemed the most frightening about it or perplexing was that if somebody has it, they frequently think they don't, and that any suggestion that they need medical help is part of some conspiracy. So I would think it must be difficult to get people to even come into the doctor to be evaluated if, unlike this physician you were mentioning who seemed to be more aware, but from what I've heard and seen, it seems once you're irrational or delusional, you're not going to think that you need help.
Well, for example, you have a belief that you work in this radio station and that you're married. And if somebody said you should see a psychiatrist because of these beliefs, you would probably not take kindly to that. And that's the situation we find ourselves in. I have a small handful of people I've now worked with for decades that came to me to demonstrate to their parents that they were not ill. That's their entry to seeing me. And we talked about how their life was going and that they were not ill. But then we talked about what was not going the way they wanted it to and what was more difficult and why that was more difficult. And it's not my need to convince somebody that they have a specific diagnosis or that they have an illness that they don't want to agree with. It is my issue to try and help people get their life to be closer to what they want. And so we look for areas of agreement. And if down the road they happen to agree or disagree, that's okay. I don't lie about it, but I'm willing to say that we see the world very differently. One man I worked with believed he was God and was going to live forever, and he knew that I didn't believe that, and he did believe that. And he took medication on a very regular basis, not because he was ill and not because he had schizophrenia, but because when he took medication, the sparks wouldn't fly and he could work more effectively and people wouldn't hassle him at work. And when he went off the medication, the sparks would fly and people would hassle him more at work, and work was very important to him.
So he was actually willing to sacrifice his deep-seated belief.
No, he continued to have his belief. He just knew that medication made his life better.
So it was more a practical thing. He could still believe he was God.
At no point did he and I ever agree on his diagnosis. At no point did he and I ever agree on the nature of the problem. We just agreed that on a practical matter, when he took medication, his life went better in ways that were important to him. And that was enough for me, and that was what he could tolerate.
So are there people who are well known today other than John Nash who are pretty much known to be or to have been schizophrenic, who are functioning, you know, at a high creative scientific level?
Well, Ellen Sachs would be an example, and there are also a small handful of other people like that. Fred Fries is a man who just retired from being the chief psychologist at the largest state hospital in Ohio, which was the hospital he'd been committed to a number of times when he was younger. He and I...
It's got to be unusual.
Well, most people with schizophrenia don't get PhDs, but then most of the rest of us don't get PhDs either. Having schizophrenia makes everything more difficult. It doesn't make it impossible. There are many people with schizophrenia who are unable to work. There are many other people with schizophrenia who would be able to work if they were given some help and assistance about that. And there's some people with schizophrenia who, despite their illness, can go out and get the job on their own. So we're talking about a whole wide variety of people. Fred Fries, who's quite public about this, continued to have psychotic symptoms on medication through his entire adult life. I co-presented with him, and during bad periods, he'd be hearing voices as he was working and was able to shunt them off with some difficulty. And so there are people out there. The problem is that if somebody with schizophrenia is not doing well, if they're panhandling on the street or they're not walking, then you say, that person has a mental illness. But when you walk into the bank teller with schizophrenia doesn't have a big S on her chart. And your dentist doesn't have a big S on her chart. And the person working your radio station doesn't have a big S emblazoned on his forehead. So you only know about people with schizophrenia if they're willing to tell you about it or if, in fact, they're not doing well. The physician that I talked about is very, very secret about his disorder. He's very careful about who knows and who does not, for good reason, because of the stigma that's involved with that. So many people with schizophrenia who are doing very well, in fact, are quite private about it. Now, I don't want to pretend that most people with schizophrenia are doctors and lawyers or getting PhDs. It is a terrible disabling disorder that makes all kinds of life much, much more difficult. I do want to leave hope that there is, in fact, a range of outcome, and we are most cognizant of the people who are doing least well.
I'm intrigued that the hallucinations, if that's even exactly the right word to use, tend to be auditory. Are there also schizophrenics who have visual hallucinations?
There can be any kind of hallucinations. One of the women I worked with had bugs crawling up and down inside her skin, and she was unwilling to take medication from me because this was not a psychiatric condition, but she was willing to take medication from a dermatologist who reported that it would help the feeling of bugs, which in fact it did. And I think it's important, by the way, not to lie to people, that in fact he gave her medication to decrease her sensitivity to the feeling of bugs.
The feeling of bugs, not necessarily the bugs. They couldn't find any bugs.
They looked in a microscope. What was driving her crazy was, in fact, the feeling of bugs. Right. And, in fact, the medication worked. It's very important to be respectful and to be honest because you're talking about not getting somebody to take medication or to be in treatment for a week or a month, but to come to a relationship with their illness and the need for treatment for their illness over a lifetime. And that requires a respectful honesty.
So you're not necessarily, in treating schizophrenia, you're not necessarily trying to convince that person out of his or her delusions or disconnected from reality perceptions. You are, in a sense, playing along with them.
I'm not playing along with them. My guess is if you and I talked long enough, we'd find areas of the world that we agreed with and areas of the world we disagreed with. And if we liked each other, we would focus on those areas that we agreed with. And if we didn't like each other, we would remember and take away those areas that we disagreed with. That's not playing along with. It's what we choose to focus on. What I want to do is I want to focus on what I call the pro-social, the healthy side of the person, and what I can do to help them. So if, in fact, you want to get a job, you want to get a used car, you want to live independently, you want to go back to school, my job is to help you get there. My job is to help you accomplish those pro-social goals. It doesn't require insight. It may not even at the beginning require medication. It requires relationship and an understanding of what the problem is and a mutual collaboration to getting to that problem. If down the road we have a disagreement about the cause of the problem, but you're in fact doing things that in my estimation are going to make your life better, in ways that you've defined it, that's enough. Insight is an overrated commodity.
We're going to talk about medications and other forms of treatment and intervention when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Ronald Diamond. And we're talking about schizophrenia. And Ronald Diamond, among other positions, is also the author of the third edition of The Layman's Approach to the Subject, Instant Psychopharmacology. So far, we've been dwelling a fair amount on those aspects of schizophrenia that schizophrenics have that other people don't have, you know, hearing the voices and perhaps a sense of persecution or some sense of collusion or conspiracy. But are there things that schizophrenics are lacking that others do have?
Yes. If you think of positive symptoms as the things that you get with schizophrenia that you'd rather not have, negative symptoms are the things that the illness takes away that you'd rather keep. And this includes persistence, spontaneity, ability to be entrepreneurial, think about the future. And in fact, when you look at this, the negative symptoms of schizophrenia, the lack of spontaneity and persistence and motivation, interferes with one's life much more than do positive symptoms. You can hold a job if you're hearing voices, and you can hold a job if you believe you're God. But you can't hold a job if you don't have any motivation. You can't hold a job if you don't have any persistence to go from one point to another. And even worse than that are something called cognitive dysfunction. We know that people with schizophrenia, and again, this is variable. So some people have a lot of one of these and some people have very little. But many people with schizophrenia have problems with executive function, with abstract reasoning, with verbal memory deficits. Let me explain what that is. If you're going grocery shopping tonight, this is Friday, you have to think, well, how much money do I have for the month? What's going to go bad in the next couple of days? Who's coming over for dinner Sunday? And as you go through grocery shopping, there are a tremendous number of different independent choices that you need to make to be a successful grocery shopper. If you can't think about the abstract problem of what you're going to want Sunday for dinner when it's not Sunday and what you're going to have to keep back to go grocery shopping next week when it's not next week, you're not a successful grocery shopper. If you're not a successful grocery shopper, what happens is you start eating in fast food restaurants because you have no food in your apartment. And if you're living on Social Security, you start running out of money halfway through the month. Then you're without money and you're without food. And if you're a smoker, and we know that 80% of people with schizophrenia smoke, and there's a neuroscience reason why smoking is particularly prevalent in people with schizophrenia, then you're without cigarettes, so you're in nicotine withdrawal. And after a period of time, the voices start getting worse and worse, and the pressure gets worse and worse. And you come into the emergency room saying, the voices are telling me to kill myself and I have to go back in the hospital. You don't come into the emergency room saying, I'm a poor grocery shopper and that's why I ran out of money. But in fact, what happens when you're not able to do something because of these cognitive deficits is the world starts tumbling in on you. And various parts of your social ecology, things that need to work to keep you stable, start falling apart. And so when we talk about schizophrenia, we can talk about the dramatic positive symptoms. We also need to talk about the negative symptoms and the cognitive dysfunction and how we can apply treatment to make sure we meet the needs of people who have these particular deficits.
So this particular deficit is that the schizophrenic is unable to sort of project ahead and imagine him or herself into a situation such as needing something to eat for Sunday night.
And is that because there's so much noise in the head?
It seems to. Now, again, I want to be clear that not everybody with schizophrenia hears voices. Not everybody with schizophrenia has abstract reasoning problems. But this is the syndrome that makes up the triad. And it's not just from the positive symptoms. They're independent. So, in fact, you may have tremendous problems with abstract reasoning and have no psychotic symptoms at all at this point. Or you may, in fact, have lots and lots of voices in your head but have perfectly good abstract reasoning. They seem to be independent parts of the disorder.
Well, let's talk about medication.
Okay.
Because I'm assuming that for most people with schizophrenia, medication is a major help.
It is. It is not enough. It is not a cure. But in fact, it is a major help. And we know that the vast majority of people with schizophrenia will have better quality of lives and more stable lives if they take medication than if they don't. What the medications primarily do is they help the positive symptoms and some of the thinking disorganization. What the medications do less well with is the negative symptoms and some of the cognitive dysfunction, the thinking problems. And for that part of things, psychosocial treatments are much more effective. They're going to work much better for most people if they're also taking medication. Now, we do make the assumption that everybody with schizophrenia needs medication, and that's probably oversold. We know that the vast majority of people will work better with it. We also know there are at least some people where medication doesn't seem to help, and all it does is cause side effects, but that's a relatively small group. Also, John Nash in A Beautiful Mind actually did not take medication. In the movie version, they put him as having responded to medication and recovering from that, and that was a political issue because both John Nash and the people around him did not want to support the idea that most people can do this without the need for medication. Medication is really important for most people. It's not enough, and it's not the only thing.
I have to ask back on the subject of cigarettes, though. What's the connection? Why 80% of schizophrenics are smokers?
People with schizophrenia. Well, it turns out that people smoke because if you really slam a nicotinic acid receptor in the brain, you attend more, you are more appetitive, you look forward to things. It is a very positive experience, which is why cigarettes are so particularly addictive to people across the board. There's a lot of suggestion that people with schizophrenia are particularly have deficits in that exact part of the brain that freebasing nicotine helps. I should mention that when you take nicotine in a patch or when you take nicotine in gum, what you have is very slow rise times of activity on the receptor. But when you smoke it, you're basically freebasing it. You get this tremendous
slamming
hit.
Right
you
in.
Just slam the receptor, and that seems to help compensate for some of the deficits. And people with schizophrenia tend to actually attend better, have a bigger improvement with smoking than people without schizophrenia.
But not
do.
To the point where somebody would actually prescribe smoking for schizophrenia?
Well, there's a couple of problems. One is the delivery system is pretty toxic. It kills people.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And the other is that the effect doesn't last, that it's enough to get you addicted to it and stuck on it, but it's not as though it's a treatment that continues. So one of the pharmacological research approaches is can we find a drug that triggers this same system in the brain but that doesn't wear off as rapidly as cigarettes do?
So you need a higher dosage? Is that the idea? I mean,
if you're smoking three or four packs a day, there's a limit.
Yeah.
There's a limit.
So what are some of the main drugs currently being used to handle the symptoms of schizophrenia?
Well, the primary drugs are antipsychotic medications, and these were first introduced in 1953 with chlorpromazine or Thorazine, spread rapidly through the 1960s and to the current purpose. The older type or first-generation drugs had many side effects, most of which were connected to motor side effects. People would have tremors or restlessness, and they could even develop irreversible movement disorders called tardive dyskinesia. About 20 years ago, a group of second-generation drugs were developed that seemed to have much less tendency to cause motor side effects, much less tendency to cause people to be wooden and look odd, less tendency to cause tardive dyskinesia. Unfortunately, as it's turned out, these drugs had their own side effects. Many of them cause massive weight gain and increased risk of diabetes. So we've traded one risk of side effects for another. The other question is, are the new drugs any more effective than the old drugs? And this is a whole academic enterprise. You can make your 10-year career with this. What we know is that clozapine is the one drug that is remarkably more effective than any other medication. And somebody who's not doing well with their illness should be given a trial or at least offered a trial of clozapine before we decide that this is all that a medication can do. The problem is that clozapine is a difficult drug to take and to prescribe. It causes weight gain, can increase diabetes, causes sedation, causes drooling, and needs to be monitored. And 1% of people who take clozapine will stop making white blood cells, which can cause a medical emergency. So it's a medically complicated drug, and the reason we use it is because it is so effective. The reason we don't use it first is because it has so many side effects. The other newer drugs, risperidone, Geodon, Abilify, and the drugs that we hear about, may have some marginal advantage over the older drugs. There are a couple of very large government-sponsored trials that did not show that these drugs have much increased effectiveness. Some of us who have used these medications for long periods of time continue to believe that over a longer period of time in what I call a socially rich environment, these drugs allow some people to recover more than the old drugs did. And by that, I mean if you're somebody who's sitting watching TV, not expected to do anything in a group home, I don't think you're going to see much difference between the old drugs and the new drugs because the effects are pretty subtle. But if you're in an environment that encourages you to go to work, go to school, interact with other people, do things, then over a period of 6 months or a year or 2 years, I have a personal belief, not great data, but a personal belief, that the new medications are permissive and supportive for some people in a way that the old medications are not.
So if I'm living with a person who's been diagnosed with schizophrenia, what should I do to make their life easier?
Well, first of all, you should make sure they get into effective help. That means seeing a psychiatrist who's comfortable, probably working with a team. Often for this person to get reengaged in the world, they're going to need more than just medication. They're going to need some help getting back to school or help getting back to work or help making friends. The things that were at one point relatively easy for this person now are going to become much more difficult, and they're going to need a coach or a person to help organize or to teach skills. For example, I had a young man whose goal was to get a girlfriend, and he had no idea how to do it. And he would do it in very crude ways that got him into significant trouble. But if you actually sat and talked to him, he didn't know how to talk to a girl. And so just teaching basic skills, how do you talk to a girl? How do you begin a conversation? What does a conversation look like? How do you make eye contact? Was the precursor skills that he needed to have. And this is somebody who was on medication and whose psychotic symptoms were under good control. The other thing you need to do is to educate yourself. And there are now some very good resources to educate yourself as a family member, as a friend, as a neighbor. The first place I'd go is to the NAMI website, NAMI.org.
And we can put a link to that on our website. That's National Alliance for Mentally Ill?
The National Alliance for Mentally Ill. This is a national grassroots support organization that was started here in Madison. The first national meeting was about 25 years ago now here in Madison, and it's now has hundreds of thousands of members. And is a source of information. They have training courses for both people with the illness, with SIBs, for family members, for parents. It's a very important resource, and it's also a great place to go and look stuff up because I think the website gives reliable information, and they point to other websites that they vetted as being reliable.
So if you had to say, just as a way of summing up, what you most, as a sort of take-home message, want someone to not think about schizophrenia and for them to think about it, what would that be?
What I want them to not think about is to connect it that people are violent or that you need to stay away or you should be afraid of hurting somebody. What you should be thinking about is to be hopeful. It's a terrible disorder that people, in fact, can improve their quality of life. They can walk through what I call a recovery journey of trying to help their life to be closer to what they want it to be, that there is room for cautious optimism. That, in fact, people can get their lives back in many cases, much more than they ever would have thought, that having had the opportunity to work with people over three decades, the same people, you see people grow and blossom and change. Their life may not have been exactly on the same course they wanted it to be when they were 15 or 20 or 25, but many people are able to achieve life courses that are, in fact, satisfying to them, that are stable, that are connected to other people, and that fulfill the requirements of a reasonable life.
Ronald Diamond, thank you for joining us for the hour and enlightening us about schizophrenia. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. It's an instrument that you hear a lot at this time of year, and next Sunday afternoon at 4, our guest, Mark Hetzler, will tell us about the art of the trombone, an ancient instrument that is very much with us today. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 for University of the Air right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.